How did you wind up on the Alcina? Where is your family? Where is Mr. Loafbeer? What's your favorite song? I'll learn it and play it 100 times if it means you will sit and watch me again tomorrow. Well, Madame Loafbeer says, her smile tight, it is late. We must sleep. Thank you for the concert. It was lovely. With a quick nod in Addie's direction, she links elbows with her daughter, and they make their way through the arched doorway toward their cabin, the soles of their buffed ankle strap heels knocking softly on the hardwood floor. Bonne nuit, Addie Kurtz, Alishka calls over her shoulder. Bonne nuit, Addie replies, a bit too loudly. Every part of him wishes Alishka would stay. Should he ask her to? It had felt so good to flirt with her. It had felt so normal. No, he'll wait. Be patient, he tells himself. Another night. Chapter 16. Genek and Herta. Altunai, Siberia, February 1941. Nothing could have prepared Genek and Herta for the Siberian winter. Everything is frozen. The dirt floor of the barracks, the straw scattered over their log bed, the hairs on the inside of their noses, even their spit, long before it hits the ground. It's a wonder that there is still water at the pit of the well. Genek sleeps fully clothed. Tonight he wears his boots, hat, a pair of gloves he'd purchased when the snow first started falling in October, and his winter coat. It is lucky he'd thought at the last minute to bring it from Lvov. And still, he aches from the cold. The feeling is intense. It's nothing like the dull pain between his shoulder blades after hours spent heaving his axe, but rather a deep, relentless throb that pulses from his heels, up through his leg bones, into his gut, and out his arms, triggering spastic involuntary full-body shivers. Genek curls and uncurls his fingers and wiggles his toes, nauseated by the thought of losing one. Nearly every day since November, someone at the camp has awoken to find an appendage black with frostbite. When it happens, there's often no other choice but for a fellow prisoner to amputate. Genek watched a man once writhing in pain as his small toe was sawed off with the dull blade of a pocket knife. Genek had nearly fainted. He inches his body closer to Herta's. The bricks he'd warmed by the fire and wrapped in a towel to set at their feet have gone cold. He's tempted to burn some more wood, but they've already used their 2 allotted logs, and sneaking out under Romanov's watch to steal an extra from the pile would be reckless. This godforsaken land has turned on them. 6 months ago, when they'd first arrived, the air was so hot they could hardly force it into their lungs. Genek would never forget the day their train finally screeched to a stop, and the doors were thrown open to reveal nothing but pine forest. He'd leapt to the ground, clutching Herta's fist in one hand and his suitcase in the other, his scalp swarming with lice, the skin over his vertebrae scabbed from leaning against the splintered wooden wall of the train car for 42 days and nights. Fine, he thought, looking around at their surroundings. They were alone in the woods, impossibly far from home, but at least here they could stretch their legs and urinate in private. They'd walked for 2 days in the blistering August heat, dehydrated and dizzy with hunger, before arriving at a clearing with a long one-story log barracks that appeared to have been built in a hurry. When they finally set their suitcases down, their exhausted bodies reeking and sticky with sweat, they were welcomed with a few select words from Romanov, the black-haired, steel-eyed guard assigned to their camp.
The closest town, Romanov said, is 10 kilometers south. The villagers there have been warned of your arrival. They want nothing to do with you. This, he barked, pointing at the ground, is your new home. You will work here, you will live here. You will never again see Poland.
Genek had refused to believe the words. There was no way Stalin could get away with this, he told himself. But as the days turned into weeks, and then months, The strain of not knowing their future began to chip away at him. Was this it? Was this how they were destined to live out their lives, felling logs in Siberia? Would they, as Romanov promised, never go home again? If that were the case, Genek wasn't sure if he could live with himself. For not a day passed that he wasn't reminded of the fact that it was his own pride that had put them here in this horrific camp, a truth that weighed on him so heavily that he feared he might soon break. The worst of it, though, the peace that tormented Genek more than any other, was the fact that it wasn't just his wife for whom he was accountable anymore. She didn't realize it at the time, but Herta was newly pregnant when they left Lvov, a surprise, of course, and one they'd have celebrated if they still lived in Poland. By the time they figured it out, they'd been cooped up on the train for weeks. Herta had mentioned just before their arrest that she was late, but considering the stress they were under, it didn't strike either of them as strange. A month later, her period still hadn't arrived. 6 weeks after that, her waistline had thickened enough, despite the lack of food, to announce the baby's arrival. Now she's weeks from giving birth to their child in the middle of a Siberian winter. Genek shivers as a loudspeaker clicks on, spitting static into the frigid air. He groans. All day and into the night, the speakers spew propaganda, as if the incessant rants will convince the prisoners that communism is the answer to their problems. Fanatical revolutionary ideology fills their ears all day, and now, nearly fluent in Russian, Genek can understand the majority of the nonsense, making it impossible to tune it out. He drapes an arm gently around his wife and rests a palm on her belly, waiting for a kick. Herta says the baby is most active at night, but there isn't any movement. Her breathing is heavy. How she can sleep through the cold and the roar of the loudspeaker is a mystery. She must be spent. Their days are grueling. Most involve cutting down trees in the bitter cold, hauling logs from the forest across slippery, frozen bogs, and over windswept snow dunes to a clearing, and piling them on sleds for the horses to pull away. Genek is done in to the point of delirium by the end of each 12-hour shift, and he's not carrying a child. In the past 2 weeks, he's begun begging Herta to stay put in the mornings, fearful that she'll overexert herself on the job, that the baby will arrive while she's stranded in the middle of the woods, knee-deep in snow. But they've already sold every keepsake and article of clothing they can live without for extra food, and they both know that the moment Herta stops working, their rations will be cut in half.
"You don't work, you don't eat," Romanov reminded them often.
Then what? The loudspeakers finally go silent, and Genek exhales, relaxes his jaw. Blinking into the darkness, he makes a silent promise that this will be the first and last winter they spend in this frozen hellhole. He doesn't have it in him to survive another.
"You got us here, you can find the way out."
He will figure a way. Perhaps they can escape. But where would they go? He'll think of something. Some means to protect his family, his wife, his unborn child. They are all that matters. And to think that all it would have taken was a checkmark, a willingness to feign allegiance to the Soviets until war's end. But no, he was too prideful. Instead, he'd marked himself as a resistor. Fuck! What has he gotten them into? Genek clamps his eyes shut, wishing with every part of his being that he could go back in time, that he could transport them to a better place, a safer place, a warmer place. In his mind, he travels to the clear waters of Lake Arbatka, where he and his siblings spent endless afternoons in the summertime, swimming and playing hide-and-seek in the nearby apple orchards. He visits the sunny shores of Nice where he and Herta once spent a week basking on a black pebbled beach, drinking sparkling wine, and feasting on generous portions of mühl frites. Finally, his memory skips to Radom. What he would do to sit down to a lavish dinner at Wirtspitzky's, to settle in with his friends for back-to-back pictures at the local movie house. For a moment, Genek is lost, the memories wrapped around him like blankets, easing the cold. But he is jolted back to his icy barracks when, in the distance, a wolf howls, its sorrowful call echoing through the trees on the outskirts of camp. He opens his eyes. The forest is full of wolves. He sees them every now and then while he's working. And at night, the howling has recently grown louder, closer. How hungry would a pack have to get, he wonders, before venturing into camp? The fear of being torn apart and eaten by a wolf seemed childish, like something his father would have threatened in jest when he refused to eat his cabbage as a boy. But here in the woods, in snow-smothered Siberia, it feels eerily possible. As Genek contemplates how exactly he would go about staving off a hungry wolf, his heart begins to punch at his ribs, and out of his mind pours a barrage of horrific what-if scenarios. What if he simply isn't strong enough, and in the end, the wolf wins? What if there's a complication in Herta's labor? What if the baby, like the last three born in the camp, doesn't make it? Or worse, what if the baby survives and Herta doesn't? There is one doctor left living among them, Dembowski. He's promised to help deliver their child, but Herta. The odds of survival for the average prisoner in Altinai narrow by the day. Of the 300-some Poles who arrived at the camp in August, over a quarter have died of starvation, pneumonia, hypothermia, and one he doesn't dwell on, in childbirth. Their bodies lay to rest in the forest, exposed to the snow and the wolves, the ground too frozen for a decent burial. Another howl. Genek lifts his head and glances toward the door. A sliver of moonlight glows beneath it. Overhead, he can make out the shadows of icicles suspended from the beams of the barracks, trained like daggers at the dirt floor. Returning his cheek to the straw mat beneath him, he presses his shivering body tighter to his wife's, willing himself to sleep. Chapter 17. Addy. Dakar, West Africa, March 1941. Addy and Eliska sit staring at the sea, watching as a liquid sun sinks toward the horizon. A cool breeze rustles the giant leaves on the coconut trees behind them. This is their third visit to the crescent-shaped Plage de la Boile d'Or. Tucked away behind the Parc Zoologique and an ancient Christian cemetery, the beach is an hour-long walk from the port of Dakar. At each visit, they've had it entirely to themselves. Addy brushes a few silvery flecks of sand from his forearms, which over the past 10 weeks have browned to the shade of toasted Maltona bread. He never imagined when he set sail from Marseille in January that he'd wind up in Africa with a tan. But since the Alcina was detained in Senegal by British authorities, "This is a French ship, and France is no longer a friend of the Allies," their captain was told, Addy's skin had grown accustomed to the relentless West African sun. The Alcina has been anchored for 2 months. The passengers haven't an inkling of when or if they'll be allowed to sail again. The only date Addy knows for sure, the date he is acutely aware of, is the one 2 weeks from now when his visa will expire. "I'd do anything for a swim," Eliska says, her shoulder grazing Addy's. They didn't believe it at first when the locals told them the sea was infested with great whites. But then they saw the headlines in the paper. "Shark attack, death toll rises," and began spotting shadows beneath the water surface from the bow of the Alcina, long and gray like submarines. On the beach, sharp, heart-shaped teeth washed up by the dozens, pricking the soles of their feet if they weren't careful where they stepped.
Me too. Shall we tempt the fate, as the Americans say?
Addie smiles, thinking of the night, 2.5 years ago, that he'd learned the expression. He'd been at a cabaret in Montmartre and had taken a seat beside a saxophonist who turned out to be from Harlem.
Willie.
Addie remembers the conversation well. He told Willie that his father had lived for a short stint in the States, an adventure that has always intrigued Addie to no end, and had peppered poor Willie with endless questions about life in New York. Hours later, to Addie's great amusement, Willie offered up a few of his distinctly American idioms, which Addie scribbled in his notebook.
Tempt fate, break a leg, and close but no cigar were among his favorites.
Alishka laughs, shakes her head.
Tempt the fate? Did you get that one right? She asks.
Addie is obsessed with his American sayings and is reluctant to admit to butchering them on occasion.
Probably not. But what do you say, shall we?
I will if you will, Alishka says, narrowing her eyes at him as if daring him to accept the offer. Addie shakes his head, marveling at the ease with which Alishka is able to laugh off danger. Aside from complaining about the heat, she hasn't seemed fazed by their 2-month detour in Dakar. He turns to her, blowing playfully into the blonde hair over her ear and studying her scalp as his mother used to study the skin of the chickens at the market in Radom.
You look just right, he says, cupping his hand into the shape of a C. It's supper time. I bet the sharks are hungry.
He clamps down on Alishka's knee.
Net for, Alishka shrieks, slapping his hand away.
Addie catches her hand.
Net for? This is new. Tu es un net for, she says. Un monstre. Tu comprends?
They speak French together, but Alishka has been teaching Addie a dozen or so Czech words a day.
Monstre? Addie banters. That was nothing, Bevette.
He wraps his arms around her, biting her ear as they roll backward, their heads landing softly on the sand. They'd discovered the beach 2 weeks before. The fresh air and seclusion are heavenly. The others from the ship aren't brave enough to venture so far off on their own, and the locals don't seem to have much interest in the beach.
What with their dark skin and all, why would they?
Lishka once quipped, prompting Addie to ask her if she'd ever seen a black person before. Like many of the others aboard the Alcina, until she set foot in Dakar, she hadn't. Most of the Alcina's European refugees refused, in fact, to converse with the West Africans, a behavior Addie found absurd. Racism, after all, the very root of Nazi ideology, was the reason most of them had fled Europe.
Why wouldn't I want to get to know the Africans, he'd asked, when Alishka questioned why he thought it necessary to mingle with the locals. We're no better than them.
And besides, he'd added, the people are everything. They're how you come to know a place. Since they arrived, he'd befriended several of the shopkeepers who manned the stores lining the harbor, even bartered with one. A photo of Judy Garland torn from a magazine left by a passenger in the Alcina's first-class lounge for a colorful string bracelet that Addie had tied around Alishka's wrist. Addie checked his watch, stands, and pulls Alishka to her feet.
It's time already?
Alishka pouts.
Oui, ma chérie.
They carry their shoes as they make their way back down the beach in the direction from which they'd come.
I hate leaving this place, Alishka sighs. I know, but we can't afford to be late.
They talked a sentry into giving special permission to disembark the Alcina between noon and 6 in the evening. If they broke curfew, the privilege would be revoked.
How is Madame Lothbier today? Addie asks as they walk.
Alishka chuckles.
La grande dame! She's... How do you say it?
A bourreau.
A curmudgeon.
In the past month, Alishka's mother has made it quite clear that there is nothing acceptable about Addie courting her daughter. It hasn't anything to do with the fact that he's Jewish, Alishka assures him. The Lovebeers are Jewish too, after all. It's that he's a Pole, and in Magdalena's mind, her Swiss boarding school educated and bright future daughter is far too good for a Pole. Addie is determined to win over Madame Lovebeer, though, and has gone out of his way to treat her with nothing but the utmost respect and deference.
"Don't worry about my mother," Alishka sniffs. "She doesn't like anyone. She'll come around. Just give it some time."
"The circumstances are a bit étrange, wouldn't you say?"
"I suppose," Addie says, although he's never met a soul who didn't like him.
They walk slowly, enjoying the open space around them, chatting about music and films and favorite foods. Alishka reminisces about growing up in Czechoslovakia, about her best friend Lorena from the international school in Geneva, about her summers in Provence. Addie talks about his favorite cafes in Paris, his dream to visit New York City and the jazz clubs in Harlem, to hear some of the greats in person. It feels good to converse like this, in a way that they might have before their worlds were turned upside down.
"What do you miss the most about life before the war?" Alishka asks, looking up at him as they walk.
Addie doesn't hesitate.
"Chocolate. The dark kind from Switzerland," he beams.
"The Alcina had depleted its supply of chocolate weeks ago," Alishka laughs.
"And you," Addie asks, "what do you miss the most?"
"I miss my friend Lorena. I could tell her anything. I suppose I still do in my letters, but it's not the same in writing."
Addie nods. "I miss people too. I miss my family," he wants to say, but he doesn't.
Alishka's parents are separated, and she isn't close with her father, who is in England now, as are many of her friends, including Lorena. She has an uncle who lives in Brazil, and that's it. That's the extent of her family. Addie knows, too, that despite the daily complaints, Alishka loves her mother dearly. She has no concept of what it might feel like to live without La Grande Dame. She's not lying awake at night as Addie is, worried sick about the fate of loved ones left behind. It's different for him. It's unbearable at times. He hasn't a clue as to the whereabouts of his parents, his siblings, his cousins and aunts and uncles, his baby niece. He doesn't even know if they're alive. All he knows is what the newspaper reports, none of which is promising. The latest headlines confirm what the Poles on the Alcina have told him, that the Nazis have begun rounding up entire communities of Jews, forcing them to live four and five to a single room in roped-off neighborhoods, ghettos. Most major cities now have one, some two. The thought of his parents being evicted from their apartment, forced to surrender the home where he'd spent the first 19 years of his life, the home they'd worked so hard to acquire, makes Addie's stomach turn. But he can't talk about the headlines with Alishka, or about his family. He's tried a few times, knowing that just hearing their names spoken aloud would help make them feel more present, more alive, in his heart at least. But each time he broaches the subject, she's brushed him off.
"You look so sad when you talk of your family," she says. "I'm sure they're fine, Addie. Let's talk of only the things that make us happy, the things we have to look forward to."
And so, he's humored her, and, if he's being perfectly honest, let himself be distracted, catching in their frivolous chatter a moment's relief from the crushing weight of the unknown. As they round a bend, they see the silhouette of the Alcina's cylindrical steam towers jutting up over the horizon. From afar, the ship appears toy-like compared with the monstrosity anchored beside it, a 250-meter-long battleship with quadruple turrets that soar four stories into the sky. The Richelieu has been detained, along with the Alcina, by the British. When either vessel will be able to sail again remains a mystery.
"We should be thankful," Addie says, when Madame Lovebeer complains about the hopelessness of the situation. "We have a roof over our heads, food to eat. It could be worse." In fact, it could be much worse. They could be starving, forced to beg for scraps, to dig for grains of spoiled rice in the gutter,
as they'd seen some of the West African children doing the week before. Or they could be stuck in Europe. Here, at least, they have a place to rest their heads at night, an endless supply of chickpeas, and most important, a visa into a country where they'll be allowed a life of freedom. A fresh start. At the port, Addy checks his watch again. With a few minutes to spare, they pause at a roadside newsstand. His heart sinks as he reads the headlines. Glasgow hit by Luftwaffe, the front page of the West Africa Journal reads. Every day, news of the war in Europe worsens. Countries fall one after the next. First Poland, then Denmark and Norway. Parts of Finland, Holland, Belgium, France, and the Baltic states. Italy, Slovakia, Romania, Hungary, and Bulgaria have joined the Axis powers. Addy ponders the whereabouts of Willy and his friends in Montmartre, who had poked so much fun at the idea of war. Did they stay in France, or did they flee as he had? In a few weeks, Addy realizes, it will be Passover. The third Passover that he will be forced to spend away from his home. Will his family try to find a way to celebrate this year? A lump forms in his throat, and he turns away, hoping Alishka won't notice the sadness in his eyes. Alishka. He is falling in love. In love. How can he feel this way, with so much worry consuming him? There is no explanation, other than that he can't help it. It feels good. And with all that is happening around him, that in itself is a gift. He reaches for his mother's handkerchief, dabs discreetly at the tears that have materialized in the corners of his eyes. Alishka loops her arm through his. Ready? She asks. Addy nods, forcing a smile as they continue on toward the ship.
April 7th, 1941. The gates to Radom's two ghettos are sealed, confining some 27,000 Jews to the main ghetto on Vawofa Street, and another 5,000 to the smaller Glinice ghetto just outside the city. With only 6,500 rooms between the two ghettos, they are drastically overcrowded. Living conditions and food rations deteriorate by the day, and disease spreads quickly.
Chapter 18. Mila and Felicia. Radom, German-occupied Poland. May 1941. The whispers pass swiftly among the workers, like a gust of wind through tall grass. Schutzstaffel. German military. They're coming. The color drains from Mila's cheeks. She looks up from her sewing and, in her haste, pricks her forefinger with her needle. It's been over a month since the gates to Radom's two ghettos were sealed. Most of the city's Jews, those who didn't already reside in the ghetto, were given a 10-day notice at the end of March to leave their homes. A fortunate few were able to trade apartments with Poles whose homes fell within the designated ghetto borders. But the majority scrambled to find a place to live, which was exceptionally challenging, as the ghettos were already far too crowded. Even before the Jewish refugees began filing in from Pristik, a nearby village that the Germans had converted into a military camp. The Kurtzes, of course, had been forced out of their apartment and into the old quarter a year and a half ago. They were lucky, in a sense, not to have to take part in the mad rush to find a space to reside. Instead, they stayed in their two-bedroom flat on Lubelska Street, watching from a second-story window as the others filed in by the thousands. Soon after the ghetto was sealed in April, however, the Wehrmacht stationed in the city were replaced with Schutzstaffel, who brought along a new era of evil. Easily recognizable by the beetle-black uniforms and lightning-shaped S insignia, the SS prided themselves on being the purest of all Germans. Rumor spread quickly among the Jews that to become a member of the SS, officers had to prove the racial history of their families dating back to the 1700s.
These guys are true believers, Mila's friend Isaac warned. We are nothing to them. Just remember that. We are less than dogs.
As a member of the Jewish police, Isaac is in the unenviable position of working closely with the SS. He'd seen up close what they were capable of. There have been rumors at the workshop of a raid. It happens often. A swarm of SS will storm unannounced into one of the ghetto workspaces and order the Jews to line up so they can be counted, their permits checked. To live in the ghetto, the Jews must have papers deeming them worthy of work. Most without papers, the elderly, the sick, or the very young, have already been deported. The few who are left remain in hiding. They would rather take the risk of being discovered and killed on the spot than be torn from their families, especially now that word has begun to trickle back to Wawowa about the conditions of the slave labor camps where the deported are sent. Trying not to think of what will happen if Felicia is discovered, Mila has spent the past several weeks devising a plan, a way to hide her daughter in the event of a raid, and praying for her sister's return. Halina had written in February. She and Franca had made it to Lvov, she said, and she'd found work at a hospital. She would come home as soon as she could with some savings and with the drawings Adam promised. Mila hoped that soon meant in the next few weeks. Their monthly rations lasted 10 days at most. Every day their hunger grew. Every day, Felicia's spine felt sharper as Mila rang her fingertips along her back, coaxing her to sleep. Occasionally, Nehuma was able to find an egg or two on the black market, but when she did, it cost her 50 zloty, or a tablecloth, or one of her porcelain teacups. They are burning through their savings and have nearly depleted the supplies they'd brought from home. A disturbing reality, considering there is no end in sight to this life in captivity. It's dreadful, the routine of it all, the hunger, the work, the claustrophobia of living on top of one another. There is no such thing as privacy anymore. There is no space to think. Every day the streets grow dirtier, smellier. The only beings that thrive in the ghetto are the lice, which have grown so big, the Jews have taken to calling them blondies. When you found one, you burned it and hoped it wasn't a typhus carrier. Mila and her parents are becoming despondent. They need Halina now more than ever. They need the money and the IDs, but even more, they need her conviction, her will. They need someone who can lift their spirits, who can look them in the eye and declare with confidence that there is a plan that will get them out of the ghetto. Mila sets her sewing down, the tunic's buttonhole half complete, and licks a drop of blood from her finger. Felicia, she whispers, pushing her chair away from her workbench and peering between her knees. Beneath the table, Felicia looks up from her spool of thread. She's made a game of trying to roll it from one hand to the other. Tak, come. Felicia extends her arms and Mila lifts her carefully to her hip, then half walks, half jogs to the far corner of the room, to a wall lined with long bolts of viscose rayon, wool, and recycled shoddy, and beside them, a row of paper sacks, each nearly twice Felicia's size, filled with fabric scraps. Setting Felicia down on the floor, Mila glances over her shoulder at the door in the opposite corner. A few of the others in the room look up from their sewing, but go about their business. Mila squats so her eyes are level with Felicia's and takes Felicia's hands in hers. Remember the day we played hide and seek? She asks, steadying her breath and trying not to rush her words. She doesn't have much time, but Felicia must understand exactly what Mila is about to tell her. Remember you hid here and pretended you were a statue? Mila glances toward the paper sacks. When they first practiced the drill, Mila had to act out what it meant to be a statue, and Felicia had giggled watching her mother stand perfectly still. as if she were carved from a block of marble. Felicia nods, her expression suddenly sober, like that of a child much older than 2 and a half.
I need you to hide for me, love.
Mila opens the sack she'd marked at the bottom corner with a tiny X, lifts Felicia up again, and gently lowers her inside.
Sit, darling, she says.
Inside the sack, Felicia bends her knees to her chest and then feels the ground moving beneath her as her mother pushes the bag so it's flush against the wall.
Lean back, Mila instructs from above.
Felicia rests her spine tentatively on the cold cement behind her.
I'm going to wrap you up tight, her mother says. It will be dark, but only for a little while. Stay perfectly still like we practiced, just like a statue. Don't make a noise, don't move a muscle until I come find you, okay? Do you understand, love?
Her mother's eyes are wide, unblinking. She's talking too fast.
Yes,
Felicia whispers, although she doesn't understand why her mother would leave her here, in the dark, alone. The last time, it felt like a game. She remembers her mother's impression of a statue, how it had seemed silly. Today there is nothing to laugh about in the urgency of her mother's voice.
Good girl, like a statue,
her mother whispers, holding a finger to her lips and bending down to kiss her on the top of her head.
She's shaking, Felicia thinks. Why is she shaking?
In an instant, the paper sack is rolled shut, and Felicia's ears are filled with a crunching sound as the world around her goes black. She strains to hold on to the faint tap of her mother's heels retreating across the room, but all she can make out is the whirring of sewing machines and the subtle rhythmic crinkle of the paper sack, a finger width from her lips, moving with her breath. After a moment, though, there are new sounds, a door opening, a sudden commotion, men's voices yelling strange words, chairs scraping the floor. Then there are footsteps, lots of them, passing by her all at once, toward the far side of the room.
The people, the workers, are leaving.
The men continue to yell until the last of the footsteps have dissipated. A door slams shut, and then all is quiet. Felicia waits for several heartbeats, her eardrums straining, reaching. Shreds of cotton tickle her elbows and ankles, and she wants badly to move, to scratch at the places that itch, to call out. But she can still feel the tremble in her mother's touch, and decides she'd better sit quietly as she'd been told. She blinks into the darkness. After a while, just as her bottom has begun to ache, the door clicks open. Again, footsteps. She stiffens, sensing right away that they are not her mother's. Their owners traipse around the room, their boots landing heavily on the floor. Soon there are voices accompanying the footsteps. More strange words. Felicia's heart knocks hard against her chest, so hard she wonders if the men in the room might hear it. Pressing her eyes shut, she sips delicately at the dark, claustrophobic air, whispering silently to herself to stay still as a statue. Still as a statue. Still as a statue. The footsteps grow closer. The floor throbs beneath her now with every stomp. Whoever it is must be centimeters from her. What will they do if they find her? And then she hears it. A horrible crunch. Something heavy, a boot maybe, colliding swiftly with the paper sack next to hers. She gasps, then quickly covers her mouth with her hands. Shaking, she's struck by the sensation of something hot and wet between her legs, realizing a moment too late that her bladder has given way. The men begin yelling again in a sing-song voice.
Come out! Come out, wherever you are,
they taunt. A tear slides down Felicia's cheek. As quietly as she can, she cups her hands over her face, bracing herself for the blow that's sure to come. When it does, she'll be discovered, and they'll snatch her up. Where will they take her? Holding her breath, She wishes with every ounce of her 2.5-year-old soul that the men will pass. Chapter 19. Halina and Adam. Lvov, Soviet-occupied Poland, May 1941. In Halina's half-sleep, her brother Genek has escaped from whatever hell he's undoubtedly been subjected to and returned to Lvov. He's at the door to her apartment, knocking, for his flat has been confiscated and he needs a place to stay. Halina rolls to her side, feeling Adam's warmth beside her, and then her stomach clenches as she realizes she isn't dreaming. The knocks are real. Disoriented, she sits up, reaching for Adam's arm.
What time is it? Did you hear that? Who on earth? Who could it be?
A fraction of her still believes, or wants to believe, it's Genek. Adam reaches for his bedside lamp.
Franka, maybe, he offers,
rubbing the sleep from his eyes with the heels of his hands. When Halina and Franka arrived in Lvov in January, Franka had found an apartment 2 blocks south of Adam's. She visits often, but never in the middle of the night. Halina slips out of bed and into her robe, glancing at the clock. It's 1:30 in the morning. Standing perfectly still, she waits for another knock. It comes a moment later, this time faster.
Thump, 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 thump!
The fleshy outer edge of a fist beating quick and hard against wood.
NKVD!
Alina's eyes widen.
Kurva!
She curses under her breath. It's been months, as far as she knows, since Stalin shipped off his last trainful of undesirables to the east. The NKVD had come for Genek, his neighbors confirmed it. The knock like this one after midnight. Most likely they'd come for Selim too. She searched and searched and found no trace of him. Are they here now for him? For Adam? Halina and Adam had talked at first about living separately for this exact reason. Adam's work in the underground is risky. If he were caught, he'd no doubt be deported or killed. But Halina was adamant.
I didn't hike across a river and nearly die of hypothermia so we could live down the street from one another, she'd said. You have a perfect false ID. If they come for you, use it.
Adam had agreed, and soon after, they were married in a quiet 50-minute ceremony, with Jakob and Bella as the witnesses. Now, Halina wonders whether she should have been so stubborn in insisting that she and Adam share an address. Adam leaps out of bed and pulls a shirt over his head.
Let me go see what they...
Halina Eichenwald!
A second voice calls through the door, deeper, also in Russian.
Open up immediately, or you will face arrest!
Me? Halina whispers.
Since she began work at the hospital, she's learned to understand and speak Russian.
What could they want from me?
She smooths her hair behind her ears, her pulse thundering. They had prepared for a knock on the door for Adam, but hadn't thought through what to do if it was for her.
Let me, Adam tries again, but this time it's Halina who interrupts.
I'm coming. Just give me a moment, she calls.
She turns to Adam as she knots the cotton belt of her robe around her waist.
They know I'm here, she says. No use hiding. They do now, Adam whispers, his cheeks flushed. Our IDs, we could have used them.
Halina realizes her mistake.
I'm sure it's nothing, she says. Let's go.
They hurry together down the hallway. Thus far, living in Lvov has been relatively painless. They use their real names because, as Jews, they're treated much like the city's Poles. They have jobs. Franka as a maid, Adam as a railroad engineer, and Halina as a technician's assistant at the city's military hospital. They live in apartments in the center of town. Unlike Radom, Lvov has no ghetto yet. Their days are simple. They go to work, they return home, they earn enough to get by. Halina saves what little extra she can for when she returns to Radom. And of course Adam works in his spare time on IDs. For the most part, life in Lvov has been uneventful. They've been left alone. Until now. At the door, Halina gathers up her confidence. Standing as tall as her diminutive frame will allow, she unlocks the deadbolt. Outside, two NKVD officers greet her with quick, stern nods.
What can I do for you? Halina asks in Russian, one hand still gripping the doorknob.
Pani Eichenwald, one of the officers begins. We need you to come with us right away to the hospital.
What is this about? She asks.
We need your blood. Dr. Levenhead is awaiting us at the lab.
Levenhead is Halina's supervisor. He spends his days examining blood, finding matches for transfusions, and testing samples for infectious disease. Halina's job is to help prepare the tests and to write down the findings as Levenhead stares at a plate through a microscope.
What do you mean, my blood? Halina asks, incredulous.
We have a general in. He has lost a lot of blood. Levenhead says you are a match.
It was a requirement for all the hospital staff to have their blood tested when they began work there. Halina hadn't been told what type she was when her labs were run, but apparently the information was on file.
And no one at the hospital can give blood?
No. Let's go.
I'm sorry, but this isn't a good time for me. I'm not feeling well.
Halina lies. She's skeptical. What if all of this is just a ruse, a clever excuse to get her out the door so the NKVD can arrest her and send her away?
I'm afraid that's not of our concern. You're needed right away. Dress quickly.
Halina contemplates putting up a fight but knows better.
Fine, she whispers as she makes her way back to the bedroom.
Adam follows close behind.
It's not a ploy, she tells herself.
Why would the NKVD concoct such an elaborate story when, from everything she's heard, they needed no pretense to arrest her? And why would they come for just her, and not Adam, if they were to be deported?
I'm going with you, Adam declares, once they've reached the bedroom.
I'm sure they won't allow it, Halina says. Levenhead will be at the hospital. I trust him, Adam. And if they only need my blood, I'll be back by morning.
Adam shakes his head, and Halina can see the fear in his eyes.
If you're not back in a few hours, I'm coming for you.
All right.
Halina wonders about the Russian general, about what he's been responsible for. Would giving him her blood and allowing the man to live make her complicit in his actions? She shakes the thought from her mind, reminding herself that this isn't her choice. She's been able to avoid trouble so far, because she's done what's been asked of her. They need her blood? So be it. At the hospital, everything happens quickly. She's escorted to the lab, and along the way she learns that the general was brought in earlier that night for an emergency surgery. Once she's seated, a doctor in a white coat instructs her to roll up her sleeves.
Both of them? Halina asks.
Da.
Halina rolls the sleeves of her blouse to just above her elbow and watches as the man in the coat, who she presumes to be a doctor, sets a pair of needles, a rubber tourniquet, a cotton swab, two bandages, a bottle of rubbing alcohol, and a small army of collection tubes, she counts 12, on a metal tray beside her. A minute later, he brings a needle to her arm, bevel up, and pushes the tip into a vein. It hurts, more than it should, she feels, but she locks her jaw, refusing to wince. She is a puppet to these men, but this at least, the strength conveyed in her expression, she can control. Within a few seconds, the first test tube has turned a deep purple red. The doctor removes the tourniquet from her upper arm with one hand and replaces the full tube with an empty one, the needle still stuck in her arm. A nurse waits behind him, and every time a tube is full, she whisks it away in a hurry. By the sixth tube, Halina's blood moves at a slow drip, and the doctor asks her to flex and unflex her fist until the tube is filled. Finally, he removes the needle and wraps a bandage around her elbow crease, then turns his attention silently to her other arm. It's 3 a.m. when Halina is allowed to return home. She has given nearly a liter of her blood. She is lightheaded and has no idea if the general survived the night, if the transfusion was successful. But she doesn't care. She just wants to get back to Adam. The doctor scribbles a note and hands it to her as she leaves.
In case anyone asks why you are out, he says. The NKVD who had retrieved her had brought her by car to the hospital. She gathers from the note that there will not be a ride home. Just as well, Helena thinks. She's glad to be free of them. She takes the slip and leaves without a word. Her flat is 7 blocks from the hospital. She walks the route daily, knows it well. But in the dead of night, the city feels foreign. The streets are dark, empty. With every tap of her heels on the cobblestones, she becomes more convinced that someone is following her or waiting up ahead in the shadows. You're just tired, she tells herself. Stop being paranoid. But she can't help it. In her depleted state, she isn't herself. She's cold to start. It's May, but the nights are still chilly. She can't stop shivering. On top of that, her head is spinning, and her limbs feel heavy as if she's drunk. Halfway home, spooked by the sensation of being spied upon, she slips her shoes off and summons what's left of her strength to jog the last 3 blocks. Before she can extract a key from her pocket, the door swings open and Adam appears, still clothed. Thank God, he says. I was on my way out. Come in quickly. He takes her by the arm, and she grimaces when his thumb presses up against the bruise in the crease of her elbow. Helena, are you all right? I'm fine, she says. She smiles, a feeble attempt to mask the pain and her delirium. If he knew how much blood they'd taken out of her, he'd be livid, and more livid still at his inability to stop it from happening. Just tired, she adds. Adam locks the door behind her and pulls her to him, and she can feel his heartbeat through his shirt. I was so worried, he whispers. The reserve of energy Helena had tapped to jog home has disappeared, and she suddenly feels as though she might faint. I'll be fine in the morning, she says, but I need to lie down. Yes, of course. Adam helps her onto the bed. He adjusts her pillow and pulls a blanket up over her shoulders before fetching a glass of water and a few slices of apple, which he leaves on her bedside table. You take good care of me, Helena whispers. Her eyes are already closed, her breath heavy. Of us. Adam brushes her hair aside, kisses her forehead. I'm just glad you're back, he says. He undresses, turns out the light, and climbs into bed. You had me petrified. Helena can feel sleep pulling her into its abyss. Adam, she asks. She is seconds from drifting off. Yes, love. Thank you.
May 1941. Brazil's dictator Getúlio Vargas begins issuing restrictions on the number of Jews allowed into the country, calling them undesirable and non-assimilable. Infuriated by the number of visas Sousa Dantas has granted without permission in France, Vargas begins turning away refugees seeking freedom in Brazil, and issues Law 3175, forcing Ambassador Sousa Dantas to retire.
Chapter 20. Addie. Casablanca, French-occupied Morocco, June 20th, 1941. Addie surveys Casablanca's port, the column of buses parked just off the pier, the dark-skinned soldiers who have formed a human tunnel at the foot of the gangplank. The Alcina's captain had told his passengers that the ship was sent north from Dakar to Casablanca for repairs. But the heavily armed men ordering the refugees off the boat don't remotely resemble a repair team. So this is Morocco, Addie thinks to himself. In the end, the Alcina had spent nearly 5 sweltering months docked in Dakar. By the time she finally pulled up anchor in June, most of the passengers' 90-day visas to South America had long since expired. What are we to do? What if Vargas won't renew our papers? Where will we go? Retracing their route north toward Europe didn't help the mood on board, which grew increasingly frantic by the day. No one believed
that they were going to Casablanca for mechanical reasons. To quell the refugees' hysteria, the Alcina's captain promised to contact the appropriate authorities in order to guarantee passage to Rio. He would wire the Brazilian embassy in Vichy, he said, with the request for passenger visas to be extended to make up for the weeks they'd spent helplessly idle. But whether or not that telegram was ever sent or received, no one knew. For the captain, along with the crew and the refugees on board, were ordered off the boat soon after docking in Casablanca. The few passengers who could pay for a hotel were offered the option to stay in the city center, but most were to be escorted to a detention camp outside of town to await a decision by Morocco's Axis-friendly government on whether the Alcina would be allowed to sail again. As Addy descends the ship's gangplank, the soldiers wave their rifles toward the buses, shouting at the mob of foreigners spilling out onto the pier.
Allez! Allez!
Addy boards a bus and finds a seat by a window facing the pier, searching for the Lothbiers, who are no doubt among the cluster of first-class passengers gathered in the shadow of the Alcina's bow, awaiting transport to the city. He scans the crowd, but it's impossible to see much of anything through the dirt-smudged pane. Kneeling on his seat, he ratchets the window down a few inches, peers through the opening. As the bus pulls away, he spots Alishka, or at least he thinks he sees her, the top of her blonde head. She appears to be standing on her toes, looking in his direction. Pushing his hand through the crack in the window, he waves, wondering if she'll know it's him. A moment later, the bus lurches away, kicking up a cloud of dust and fumes in its wake. They drive for 45 minutes before the caravan slows to a stop at a patch of desert hemmed in with barbed wire. As Addy makes his way inside, he glances at the wooden sign over the entrance, Casa Tadla. The camp is fly-infested and cloaked in the inescapable scent of excrement, thanks to several holes dug in the dirt that serve as toilets. Addy lasts two uncomfortable nights sleeping head to toe with a pair of Spaniards in a tent built for one, before deciding he's had enough of Casa Tadla. On the morning of his third day, he sidles up to a guard at the camp's entrance and, in perfect French, offers to go to the city for a few desperately needed supplies for the group. We are out of toilet paper and soap. We are dangerously low on water. Without these things, people would be sick. They will die. He flips to the page in his pocket notebook where he scribbled papier hygiénique, savon, eau embouteillée. I speak your language and I know what we need. Take me to town. I'll purchase a few provisions. Addy rattles the change in his pocket and adds, I have some francs. I'll buy what my satchel here can hold and pay for everything myself. He smiles and then shrugs, as if he's just offered up a generous favor. Take it or leave it. After a moment's pause, the guard acquiesces. Addy is dropped at the top of Ziraioi Boulevard and told to meet back in the same place in an hour, with supplies.
1 hour!
Addy calls as he sets off, dodging donkey carts and taking in the sharp, unfamiliar aromas of a colorful spice market as he weaves his way through Casablanca's center. Of course, he won't be returning in an hour. His only intention is to track down the Lothbiers, which fortunately isn't nearly as difficult as he worried it might be. He finds them at an outdoor cafe, sipping French 75s from tall glass flutes, perched among a gaggle of long-faced men in robes cradling mugs of tea. They stand out like a couple of parakeets in a flock of doves. Alishka leaps from her chair when she sees him. After a quick celebratory reunion, Addy suggests they go back to their hotel where he can keep a low profile. It feels presumptuous to ask for their protection, but surely the guard who is expecting him on Ziraioi Boulevard will soon come looking for him, realizing he's been duped. Madame Lothbier reluctantly agrees, on the condition that Addy sleep on the floor while they await news on the Alcina's fate. 5 days later, Moroccan authorities declare the Alcina an enemy ship, claiming they discovered contraband on board. Addy and the Lovebeers find this charge hard to believe, but whether or not the ship is, in fact, carrying illegal goods, the authorities have made up their minds. The Alcina will not be leaving Casablanca. The detainees at Casa Tadla are released and, along with those who had been spared the tent camp,